Mr. Darche.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. Good morning again. If it may please the Court, my name is Doug Darche. I represent the petitioner advocate, South Suburban Hospital. Your Honor, this matter is before the Court on a petition for review of an NLRB decision. There is an issue as to the proper standard of review or the deference to be given to the ALJ's findings. And the first issue is, are statements made by an ALJ about the contents of the record demeanor-based findings, or are they fact findings which are entitled only to a substantial evidence standard of review? The ALJ made the, in our opinion, non-demeanor-based finding that there was no evidence in the record, and that's in quotes, no evidence in the record, that Hall, the central player in this case, was hostile or biased to management. The evidence on that point in the record consisted of six pieces of evidence. Hall, this witness, was disciplined on June 11th. Hall was disciplined again on August 12th. After Hall had been disciplined the second time, she gave at least two speeches disparaging the employer. She participated in the creation of two anti-employer videos. She complained about the discipline at a union meeting, describing her discipline as being unfair write-ups. She cooperated in an NLRB investigation into allegations that the second discipline was unlawfully motivated. And then she admitted that she had exaggerated in the anti-employer speeches in order to make a point. Despite this six pieces of objective evidence...
Well, it's not unusual, is it? People addressing large gatherings to exaggerate things?
Is it unusual?
Yeah. Is that would you find that unusual if that...
Well, I would find it unusual, Your Honor, to stand in the pulpit of a church, as Ms. Hall did, and falsely testify. And I would submit...
Well, I don't think she said she falsely testified. She just said she didn't diminish what she was saying. So I'm just making the point that I'm not sure that proves a whole lot, that she would...
Since she was
attempt to be rhetorically effective, isn't that what that amounts to? Well, let's not worry about the thing. I'm not
a psychiatrist, Your Honor.
A very significant point is my only reason for commenting on it.
Despite these six pieces of evidence that were not in dispute, none of which involved demeanor, the ALJ concluded there was no evidence of bias or hostility toward management.
Do we know it didn't involve a demeanor? Is that clear?
That
I mean, you've cited a bunch of things which suggest that it shouldn't have been, that she had good reason to be hostile to her employer. But is it clear that the ALJ's comment was not based in part, at least, on demeanor?
It is, Your Honor, because he makes no mention of demeanor playing any role in his conclusion as to the state of the record. His statement is based solely on the record. There is no evidence in the record. It's not, I've observed the witness. It's not, the witness impressed me as being truthful. It is, there is nothing in the whole cold, hard record to suggest bias or demeanor or hostility.
Well, part of your point, I guess, is that the two disciplinary letters or whatever they were, one June 11th and one August 12th, are you saying all of this other stuff happened after August 12th?
It did.
And there was some question about the reaction that one discipline was because of her union activity, and you're saying all this union activity occurred after the second discipline. Is that when I understand that correctly, or is there something about a picture taken and said it was later?
All right, that has not the sequence with the picture is not addressed in this evidence of hostility. The activities by Ms. Hall after the second discipline consisted of the two speeches, the two videos, and the second union meeting she attended and complained about the unfair write-ups, and the cooperation in the NLRB investigation. In our view of the facts, all of that happened afterwards. Now, The ALJ, to your point, never decided when that second union meeting occurred because he never addressed the photograph dated August 26th, which Hall claimed was when she was photographed at the union meeting. So the activity, with the exception of that photograph, the second union meeting, all of that, there's no dispute as to the fact it occurred after the discipline. She's disciplined. She then gets on her high horse, makes the disparaging remarks about her employer, participates in the anti-employer campaign on at least four occasions, goes to the NLRB, gives her affidavit. The ALJ also made some credibility resolutions. The court has laid out four tests when credibility resolutions can be overturned: when there's a physical impossibility, the testimony is incredible on its face, it's inconsistent with contemporary documents, or there's utter disregard of sworn testimony. I'd like to talk first about the inconsistency with contemporary documents. Hall's story consisted of three parts. She went to a second union meeting, she complained about unfair write-ups, and her photograph was taken. So part two of her story was she was then confronted by her supervisor, Mulvihill. Part three of the story is she was then disciplined on August 12th. There is irrefutable documentary evidence that her story is not correct. In fact, the second union meeting occurred on August 26th. Tab 3 of the appendix, page 18, is the Bates stamp number. Hall is photographed in the center of the collection of employees at the second union meeting. There's a close-up of Hall on page 19, which she is in the same uniform clothing as she is on page 18. In its brief to this court, neither the NLRB nor the SEIU makes any counter-argument. In other words, they concede the point. There's a second finding by the ALJ that's inconsistent with contemporary documents. There is a dispute in the record as to who was present at this confrontation, when it occurred, where it occurred. The only reason for those three disputes are because Susan Hall took inconsistent positions with respect to all three issues: who, where, and when. She attempted, and to her credit, managed to convince the ALJ that those inconsistent stories were not her own words. She said, "Those were speeches. They were written for me. I didn't have a chance to look at them. I simply stood up and repeated them." The irrefutable documentary evidence in the record, however, is that she was given those speeches and that she edited them. Both of the speeches are in the record. Both of them show her handwritten edits on them. They're both attached to the brief filed in this court. Finally, the ALJ's findings are inherently implausible. The ALJ found that Hall was not an open union activist or a known union organizer. No objections are taken to that. The ALJ then credited Hall's testimony that when Mulvihill confronted her, Mulvihill said to her, "I understand that you've been talking to employees about the union." It doesn't matter whether we use inherently implausible or incredible on its face. Hall's testimony fails under either standard. She could not. How could Mulvihill confront her about an unknown fact?
When was that supposed to have occurred, or is that one of the things that hasn't been established?
That, in our view, it has not been established. We deny that it ever occurred. But Hall testified it predated August 12th, but she testified that it occurred after the second union meeting. The second union meeting, we know because of the dated photograph, occurred on August 26th, thereby making Hall's story inherently implausible. And there's no, and Your Honor, if to the extent your question is an attempt to find out whether or not there was any chance the company knew that Hall was participating in union activities, the answer to that question is there is not one shred of evidence that they did know, and the ALJ specifically found that they did not know, and no one took exceptions to that finding. There are a number of other flaws in the ALJ's decision, which are discussed in our brief. We'll rely on our brief. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Darch. Mr. Side.
Good morning, Your Honor. David Side for the Labor Board. The hospital doesn't dispute that a supervisor, Movihol, made the statements that were attributed to her by Hall, and the hospital violated the act as they constituted an unlawful interrogation, threat, and impression of surveillance. Their only claim is to attack the board's demeanor-based credibility findings to assert that this incident never occurred. And the hospital has not shown any extraordinary circumstances here. The one thing that it has pointed to in its reply brief that they've kind of elevated in their reply brief and again at argument this morning is this August 26 picture to assert that this was the second union meeting and the first time that Hall could have possibly have talked about unfair write-ups. Now, if the hospital had been able to unequivocally state and show that this was the only time on August 26 that Hall had her picture taken at a union meeting, there might be a point. But it hasn't been able to show that. And to the contrary, Hall testified and would direct the court to transcript pages 132 to 35, 181 to 82, and Respondents Exhibit 13, page 1, which is her affidavit. And Hall testified that she had her picture taken for the first time at a meeting held at a convention center, and that she then went to subsequent union meetings that were in fact held at a church. And so the fact that the hospital can show to a picture that was taken at a church on August 26 does not make it extraordinary or impossible that her picture was taken at a union meeting prior to August 12th. And everything else that the hospital has tried to rely on is simply asking this court to try and reweigh the evidence and dabble in fact-finding and present possibilities or reasons why the judge could have come out with a different credibility determination. And in fact, at page 18 of its reply brief, it submits that this court could infer that Hall is telling a fabricated story. But the issue before this court is that the company has to be able to show not that this court could infer differently or that the judge could have found differently, but an extraordinary circumstance that the judge had to find differently. And it certainly hasn't done so here. And unless this court has any questions, the board would simply ask that the court enforce its order.
You're saying that the record shows no conflict in time about admission before or after. Is it really important that this discipline took place after the August 12th meeting?
The hospital is trying to assert is that she could not have complained about any unfair write-up prior to August 12th. And that the August 26th would have been the first time she could have raised anything. However, the record does show that she does have some level one write-ups in her file prior to August 12th. She had been there for 6.5 years. There had been a handful of write-ups over the years, some level one write-ups. So it's certainly not implausible that she would have gone to a union meeting held prior to August 12th and, among other things, complained about an unfair write-up.
What were the consequences of this alleged confrontation? Was this part of an organizing campaign that failed, or is this just an isolated incident that is charged as an unfair labor practice?
Your Honor, this is the only unfair labor practice that came out of what was an organizing campaign that did begin in July, and there's nothing in the record to indicate what happened to the organizing campaign after that, but certainly there was an organizing campaign that did begin in July. And with home
I mean,
visits.
Usually these things come up as part of a bigger picture, and I was trying to find out whether there's any bigger picture here.
Your Honor, certainly there was an organizing campaign that went on. This was the only unfair labor practice to come out of it. Obviously, it's not often that a single unfair labor practice rises to the level of now being before this court, but the idea that there's an isolated unfair labor practice that does arise out of a union campaign, certainly that in and of itself is not incredible. It certainly does happen very often. And again, if there are no further questions, the board would ask that the court enforce its order. Thank you, Your Honor. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Mr. Slusky.
I may have pleased the court. Just to address that first question, that last question first, this was part of an organizing campaign. There's evidence in the record that the hospital sent a memorandum to all management as to how to respond to their campaign, and that Ms. Mulvihill was aware of the union activity in July through that memorandum, if not through other means.
Apparently, it never came to a vote.
As far as the record's concerned, it didn't proceed that far.
What was the date of that memorandum?
It was in July. I don't remember the exact date, Your Honor.
Well, was it? Okay, so it's before.
It was before
August 12th.
Yes, and I know the date is in the record. I just don't recall it. I apologize. I think it's also important to emphasize that the ALJ specifically made demeanor-based credibility findings with respect to Ms. Hall and Ms. Mulvihill. With respect to Hall, he said that her demeanor was forthright and appeared honest, that she impressed him as being sure of her recollection of salient facts, and she gave spontaneous answers, and there were other demeanor-based findings about her as well as about Ms. Mulvihill. With respect to the alleged inconsistencies, they do not rise to the level of extraordinary circumstances. The two that the employer pointed to had to do with who was present, and in two of the prior videotapes, Ms. Hall does refer to someone else being present. She refers to, in one instance, being a one-on-one conversation. In fact, it's undisputed in her terms of her testimony that the only people who spoke during the conversation were her and Ms. Mulvihill. In terms of where it took place, the evidence is clear that Ms. Mulvihill called her aside from the hallway, but the actual conversation took place in Ms. Mulvihill's office. None of this rises to the level of an extraordinary circumstance. And one other thing in terms of the photograph, the evidence that the employer relies on depicts Ms. Hall in a church, and the text describes her as being in a church, and she testified that subsequent meetings after the first one where her photo was taken did take place in a church, and that her photo was taken in addition at those subsequent meetings. And her testimony before the ALJ was that the second unit meeting that preceded the confrontation with Mulvihill took place at the Tinley Park Convention Center, and the photo is clearly taken at a church. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Slutsky. Anything further, Mr. Darch?
Very briefly, just to summarize what it appears the General Counsel's, NLRB's, and the union's argument is, we said it was demeanor. The court doesn't have to do anything. You take our word for it, it's demeanor. It doesn't matter whether we're talking about what's in the record or not, it's demeanor. It doesn't matter whether it's a finding of fact, it's demeanor. A statement about what is in the record or not in the record is not a demeanor-based finding, with all due respect to the court and counsel. The demeanor-based is, I saw the witness impressed me this way or that way. But statements about what's in the record or not is not a demeanor-based finding, and we'd ask that the proper standard of review be applied. Thank you.
Case taken under advisement. Our next case for argument this morning is Pruitt against